case of Salmeron versus Enterprise Recovery Systems and others. 08-3375. Give you a minute to sort out the coming and going. For the appellant, Mr. Levenstam?
Yes. It took me a moment to get my partner out of my way.
I see.
May it please the court. The district court exercised its inherent power to issue the harshest of sanctions below, a dismissal, in the case in which my client, Ms. Salmeron, did nothing wrong, and her lawyer, Mr. Sanchez, violated no protective order or other order of the court, or for that matter, no rule of court. Rather, what Mr. Sanchez supposedly did was to breach an informal oral understanding between counsel that was never written down by a co-defendant, USA Funds, now out of the case. In fact, neither of the remaining defendants was even a party to this oral understanding. And in that regard, I think it's very significant that the defendants do not cite a single case sustaining an inherent power dismissal for a breach of agreement among counsel. And I think there's a reason for that. The cases teach that the inherent power is primarily to be used for vindicating the court's authorities. And I would refer this court to its decision in Barnhill versus United States, where it reversed a dismissal because the offense there was considered not to be what it called a frontal assault on the integrity of the judicial system. And this supposed breach of an informal oral understanding was certainly not a frontal assault on the integrity of the judicial system. The law of this circuit is very clear in the Jepson case, the Citizens First National case, and the many cases that follow. Discovery materials are public unless the district court has made a Rule 26C finding of good cause that they should not be available to the public. And furthermore, the party that seeks protection for its documents bears the burden of demonstrating that they should be protected by showing good cause. In this situation, counsel for the USA Funds Party failed to protect its client's documents, if any of those documents indeed were suitable for protection, and that's a question that has never really been passed upon. Counsel for USA Funds never confirmed this oral understanding in writing. 2.5 months elapsed before they began producing documents, which they did on disk. They did not obtain a protective order in the interim. They sent a cover letter, which was not on the disk with the documents, which does not even reference the oral understanding, and which I commend to your reading. It's at Supplemental Appendix 23 to 24. Doesn't even make clear that any documents on that disk are confidential. It sets out in an introductory paragraph 6 or 8 categories of what's covered, does not include these agreements. Then it has a paragraph about what's not in this production but what's forthcoming. And then it finally has a paragraph that says we also have a few documents for which we will seek confidential treatment without even saying that those documents are on the disk. Furthermore, counsel referred specifically to this contract in summary judgment papers. In the end, counsel never sought a protective order to protect its documents, and it didn't remember to do so. And so, you know, we posed the question, if counsel for USA Funds could not remember that it had to prosecute a protective order with or without Mr. Sanchez, it still had the obligation and the opportunity to go to the court, how can you hold Ms. Salmeron, much less Mr. Sanchez, much less Ms. Salmeron, responsible? There's been some discussion about the attorney's eyes term of this understanding, but that does not define what confidential means. If you look at the affidavit, which is at Supplemental Appendix, page 20 and 21, you will see that there is a general reference to attorney's eyes treatment for documents of ours that are confidential. But there's no spelling out of what how that was to be determined. And we suggest, respectfully, there was a clear protective order in place already approved by the district court, which specified two ways that you could do that. One was stamping the documents. It makes sense. Anybody who's done complex litigation knows you stamp a document confidential to protect it. None of these documents, and over the two disks there were 8,000 of them, 8,000 pages, none of them were stamped confidential, and none of them were identified by page. All of them were bait stamped. None of them were identified by page in separate writing. So I believe that it is absolutely unreasonable for anyone to rely upon that oral understanding. And furthermore, upholding that oral understanding by dismissing the lawsuit would undermine this court's ruling in Jepson and its progeny, in which it says that a district court has an independent duty, although normally the district court would ratify promptly an agreement among counsel. It has an independent duty when it's talking about protecting documents from public disclosure, and dismissing a suit on this situation gives the judicial imprimatur to an agreement between counsel, an understanding between counsel that is vague in its terms without showing a good cause. So we believe that for 19 months after the initial conference, USA Funds Council failed to get a protective order. For 17 months after producing this document, they never made a showing of good cause. But furthermore, we think that dismissal was an abuse in particular because the disclosure of this document had no impact on either of the defendants, on any of the defendants really, although USA Funds is now gone, ability to defend this lawsuit. Again, I refer the court to...
The district court did say, Mr. Levenstam, that it was explicitly that there was damage to the fund and indeed to third parties.
Well, the district court, you know, respectfully, the district court didn't specify what that damage was. There was no proof offered. The fact is that the focus of this case is on an alleged conspiracy between the Enterprise Recovery Systems, which was not a party to that agreement, was not even mentioned in it, and the party that turned out to be Sallie Mae, and whether they were conspiring to cheat the federal government, not on the relationship between Sallie Mae and USA Funds, which was defined in that contract. And so I think, first and foremost, looking within the context of the litigation, as Barnhill says, you have to assess the prejudice on the course of the litigation. I don't believe there was any shown here. Bolt versus Loy, another case from this court reversing a dismissal, also focuses on prejudice in the context of this litigation. The Lujan case we cite from the Ninth Circuit, a Keetam case involving a seal violation, in which the court said that the possibility of prejudice was not enough to justify dismissal. And the only theory for how this disclosure may have had some sort of impact was tendered by the other side was that it might have coerced settlement. Well, that's sheer speculation. There's nothing in the record even suggesting that the plaintiff wanted settlement. It seems to me that it's certainly a backwards way to blackmail somebody by disclosing the information that you have on them and then saying, okay, now pay me. And finally, you have to remember that the government has an interest in this case and settlement approval was up to it. So the settlement coercion theory just makes no sense. In terms of harm outside the suit, I think the judge really oversteps its bounds and is clearly erroneous in its factual finding of 38 that there were trade secrets in the agreement. He didn't look at the agreement. If you look at the three Chronicle articles, none of them detail the kind of competitive information that in theory could cause competitive harm, although the fact that Sallie Mae owned USA Group and had this contractual relationship with USA Funds suggests that there really is not a lot of space for competitive harm in terms of the relationship between those two. And even the significant negative publicity claim The district court found, in fact, finding number 38 by virtue of the articles. If you read those articles, they come to the conclusion, they do report that the Department of Education approved that agreement. And so, although there were questions, and those questions, it seems to me, were fair questions raised, given the public interest in student funds and federal guarantees for student loans, the articles were not unfavorable. I think the district court felt that a wrong had been committed, did not appreciate the vague nature of the original production and or really give thought to the fact that 17 to 19 months had elapsed in which no protective order was raised. But the inherent authority does not exist to vindicate this kind of wrong. It is not, as this court held in Zapata Hermanos, it is not a grant of authority to do good in the world. And in fact, in Zapata Hermanos, this court reversed the district court for doing something similar to what it's done here and trying to level what it perceived as being an unlevel playing field outside the parameters of vindicating court authority, which really is where the inherent authority ought to be limited.
Taking a different but somewhat related question, and that is whether these sanctions are draconian or not. The district court seemed to rely to some degree on the behavior of this of your client with respect to previous parts of the litigation. Am I correct in that reading?
You are correct in that reading, but the district court had issued a sanction. And as we cite in the National Medical Enterprises case, you don't double sanction. This conduct was different in kind from the conduct that had occurred before.
When you sentence somebody, you look at his prior record. And in this situation, couldn't the judge say, you know, I know you disagree, but look, this was a pretty egregious thing for the lawyer to have done.
Well,
and, you know, I've been having trouble with these people. In perpetuity in this case, this is the end, I'm sorry. Isn't he allowed to take into consideration the litigation history?
In this situation, Your Honor, we believe that to be an abuse of discretion. He could certainly have sentenced Mr. Sanchez more severely, sentencing Ms. Salmeron, who was innocent of, A, the disclosure, as her uncontradicted affidavit showed, and, B, any of the prior issues pertaining to delay seems to me to be an abuse of discretion. Furthermore, you know, the district court wrote a very tough opinion, but if you look behind it, many of these delays were a day here over the weekend from Friday to Monday. They were not large delays. I'm not trying to vindicate Mr. Sanchez. I don't represent him here. But, you know, this was a case, if he had decided he wanted to write an opinion about the defendant's delays, he could have done that too, because ERS filed the first extension motion. They filed a dismissal motion which had no merit. The court threw it out in 3 days. Then they missed their deadline for filing an answer by a day, and everybody agreed they could have the extra day, just as they did with Mr. Sanchez many times. And then they filed a motion, then they filed an answer that the district court struck sua sponte because it was inadequate. And you know what? They filed a second answer that the district court struck sua sponte because it was inadequate. It took them their third try to answer that case. So there was, in terms of delay in that sense, there was some fault going on both sides, and I don't think the court held that in measure in exercising its discretion. And so I believe that given the innocence of the client, the different nature of this as opposed to the other, and the sort of one-sided approach, that it was an abuse of discretion. And what we would ask for in terms of relief is to reinstate this case and remand it with directions to proceed on the merits. We think there should be no sanction whatsoever, but if the court disagrees, any sanction should be visited upon counsel.
Let me ask you this. What does the record show about when the disclosure of this document took place, was it before or after the sanction was imposed for the
deliberation? After the sanction was imposed.
After the sanction. So the disclosure was done after the sanction.
There's also, though, another reference earlier when he reinstated under Rule 59. He says, but I want to tell you now, you've really had what amounts to a final warning, and we're not going to have any repetition of any of this, or it's going to result in a conclusion that you won't desire.
Well, this was not repetition. He was not late.
Well, I know. It was a little bit different, but the judge, even though when he recites his order,
I understand.
He says, I can't believe I didn't do something about this sooner. But, in fact, he did give out a warning, and this just keeps seeming to happen. It was different than the other, but it certainly wasn't something that...
Well, but I take the court back to the original production, the fact that there was no specification, there was no confidential stamp. Certainly, if this had been stamped confidential, if there had been issues about this made clear, if they had gone and gotten a protective order and we'd been under Rule 37, it would be a different situation, Your Honors. I had hoped to reserve a little time for rebuttal, but I see I'm not. I've asked for my relief.
Well, I'm going to give you a minute for rebuttal because we kept you up a little longer. All right. Thank you. And Mr. Sarles, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. You know, just 1 month after being sanctioned for repeatedly violating court orders and procedures, Mr. Sanchez broke his agreement with opposing counsel to keep certain documents attorney's eyes only by handing over the guarantee services agreement between USA Funds and Sallie Mae to an online publication and to other third parties. Now, Judge Shader had good reason to conclude that this was willful misconduct.
What was in that agreement that was so harmful to the defendants?
Let me preface my answer by saying that Judge Shader thought that was irrelevant because he was actually dealing with the conduct rather than what was in the agreement.
Did he ever read the agreement?
No. No.
It's not in the record.
It's not in the record. He felt that was irrelevant at that point.
We don't know what was in that agreement, but what can you tell us how it harmed you?
Sure. It's an agreement between Sallie Mae and a guarantee agency that contains their fees, their performance standards, service requirements, product descriptions. It's the kind of terms that you want to keep secret from your competitors and from other companies that you contract with. And Sallie Mae competes with Citibank.
How do you usually do that in discovery when you're disclosing such things?
Well, normally you would do it with a protective order, and I think it's important to understand how this situation developed. USA Funds attorney Mr. Sweet was required to produce certain documents as part of initial disclosures, and he prepared a draft protective order that he took to Mr. Sanchez. It was based on but modified from the existing protective order that ERS had. And Mr. Sanchez said, well, I want to make some changes of my own. I need some time. I'm busy. I'll get back to you. So Mr. Sweet said, well, okay, but if I'm going to make – I've got a few confidential documents here. Let's enter into an agreement that you'll keep them attorney's eyes only pending the presentation of the protective order. And they reached such an agreement. And then when Mr.
Was this
Sweet,
verbal or by email or what?
It was verbal, and I would point out that, you know, the Seventh Circuit Standard for Professional Conduct says attorneys must adhere to all express promises and agreements with other counsel, whether oral or in writing, which is not a statute or rule, but recognizes the practical reality that attorneys often enter into oral agreements. And in the district court, Mr. Sanchez never disputed the existence of this oral agreement. And even in an appeal, it doesn't say that it didn't exist. And he never submitted an affidavit attempting to rebut Mr. Sweet's affidavit that, in fact, they did make that oral agreement. So the existence of that agreement isn't really in question. And then what happened shortly thereafter is Mr. Sweet produced documents with a cover letter. And even though there were thousands of documents or pages of documents produced, there were only two documents identified as confidential on both the first cover letter and the second cover letter. So from Mr. Sweet's point of view, one, he had an agreement, attorney's eyes only. Two, he had identified the only two documents that he was seeking the confidential protection for. And three, he would have reasonably assumed that Mr. Sanchez would have taken those two documents and segregated them in some sort of file marked confidential or attorney's eyes only.
Now, this document, the one that was published, was one of those listed, right?
Well, it was the guarantee services agreement between USA Funds and Sallie Mae. Now, when the leak
I'm having real difficulty understanding how Enterprise Recovery Systems is hurt by the disclosure of that document.
Well, there's two things about that. One, as Judge Shader made very clear, this sanction was not only because of the harm, specific harm to Sallie Mae and USA Funds, but was designed to protect the integrity of the judicial system. It was very clear that he was fed up with this attorney by that point. He was hearing the same excuses for the leak of this document that he had heard time and time again when he didn't show up for status hearings, when he didn't meet the deadlines for filings. And it wasn't just a question of asking for continuances. He didn't file it on the deadline date, and then days later would file something and ask to file it in stanter, and for violating other court orders and procedures. Again, he was hearing, gee, I was busy, I forgot, family issues, and he was clearly no longer prepared to tolerate this kind of conduct or to accept these kind of excuses. In addition, think about Mr. Sanchez's initial reaction when the leak was disclosed. In that first brief, here's what he said. He said the agreement was leaked and published without plaintiff's counsel's knowledge or approval.
There was no harm to ERS.
Well, no,
it's a harm to the system, as the judicial system as a whole. It's a disreputable lawyer, just won't do the things he's supposed to do. But there's no particular harm to ERS other than it's in litigation.
Well, actually, Judge Shader at one point mentioned that this could cause ERS to lose business. That's at page A85.
Disclosure of that the document that he's not a part of.
Well, insofar as it had an impact on the business of USA Funds, for example, it could conceivably impact the companies that USA Funds contracted with, like ERS. It's a bit speculative, but nevertheless, what he was directing these sanctions to was the affront to the integrity of the system. And as this Court has often said, and the Supreme Court has said,
I'm just real concerned that he gave the death penalty to Ms. Almiron's claim for the wrongs of a bad lawyer, for hiring the wrong lawyer, really.
Well, you know, this Court...
She didn't condone the leak of the document. There's no evidence of that, is there?
Well, let me respond to that. First of all, this Court and the Supreme Court has often said that clients, the misconduct of attorneys is imputed to their clients. But I think that's a particularly appropriate here, because Ms. Salmeron, who is not a neophyte, she's an experienced litigant, she not only engaged Mr. Sanchez, but even after the first time he was sanctioned and the court really roasted him for all the bad conduct, she continued to engage him. And so I think it's particularly appropriate. And in addition, she's not the real party in interest here. The government is. And the government has declined at every opportunity to take on this case. It was invited to do it when she filed her complaint. At each time she amended her complaint, it received service of every court paper, including this dismissal sanctions order, and then it filed a paper in this court saying it didn't want any part of this appeal. So, Ms. Salmeron, who, unlike a lot of other types of cases, is not suing for any injury to her, but for injury to the United States, this is not the type of case where sympathy for her should override the conduct of her attorney.
And, the underlying part of it where they make reference to, first of all, it's a job action and all that, I guess, and then there's a settlement, and then somehow there's some sort of a fraudulent allegation that results in a $150,000 whatever refund or something. Does any of that enter into this situation, or is that just not relevant?
Well, it's only relevant, I think, as general background to show, the government may well see this case as kind of a personal dispute between her and ERS and not really something that affects the interests of the United States. You know, I don't want to get into the head of the government, but I think there is that background there. And, getting back to the question of the willfulness and not just that this was a question of forgetting, I think it's important to look at the way that the document was disclosed to the Chronicle of Higher Education, which Mr. Sanchez admits that he did. The most complete version of that he gives on page 72 of the supplemental appendix. And he says that he had been talking to the Chronicle reporter for months, and the reporter kept asking him for this contract. And he had refused, saying that I put him off. This is his language. I put him off and told him to refer to the publicly available pleadings. So in his own mind, he was distinguishing between publicly available documents and this agreement. So he hadn't forgotten that it was supposed to be confidential. This was an attempt to generate some publicity around this case. We can only speculate what the motives were, perhaps to try to force the government into the case. But this was willful. And the fact that when he wrote his initial brief in response to the dismissal motion, that he did not mention that he had given this document to the Chronicle, that only came out when Judge Shader started questioning him in court, could only underscore the lack of integrity that he had been showing throughout this litigation, and further justify the sanction that Judge Shader imposed, which again was directed towards this affront to the integrity of the court. And as this court has often said, the purpose of sanctions is not only directed to the particular parties in the case, but it has a deterrent value. It's designed to tell lawyers and their clients, look, we can't act like this in federal court. And I think Judge Shader's order makes it very clear that's what he was about. Mr. Sanchez not only gave this contract to the Chronicle, but also to a Mississippi attorney over whom he had no control. And the fact that it was eventually posted on WikiLeaks, we don't know who actually did the posting on WikiLeaks. But, you know, when you shoot a missile in the air, it's no defense to say, well, it didn't hit the plane. Clearly, one of those distributions, whether to the Chronicle or to the lawyer or to Ms. Samarin herself, led to the posting on WikiLeaks.
Now, is there something in that document that to follow up on what Judge Kinder was saying a while ago, is there something internally there that affects the competitive advantage or disadvantage, some disclosure of secrets or operational secrets that gives competitors an advantage if it's disclosed?
Oh, absolutely. Take two of the competitors of Sallie Mae, Citibank and J.P. Morgan Chase. If they know the prices that Sallie Mae is contracting for with its guarantors, it gives it a competitive advantage. The same with other guarantee companies. If they know the price that USA Funds is getting with Sallie Mae, it gives it an advantage. So it's kind of the classic type of commercially sensitive information that Rule 26C recognizes is subject to protection. And, you know, there's no First Amendment right to breach a confidentiality agreement. And a protective order is not the only way to restrict information in discovery from public disclosure. A confidentiality agreement can serve that purpose, especially one here where it was meant to be interim. Even though USA Fund's attorney undoubtedly should have gone to court earlier, that didn't give Mr. Sanchez the right to willfully disseminate this agreement without any kind of notice to the parties to the agreement or to the court. What he should have done, if he thought it was subject to dissemination, was go to the court, argue that it was not protectable, and got a court ruling. And that's what so incensed Judge Shader, that he never got an opportunity, really, to address that point. It was preempted by the fact that Mr. Sanchez took it upon himself to unilaterally disseminate it into cyberspace. Now, on the question of whether there was a warning, as Your Honor said, he was unquestionably warned. He was given a final warning at the time of the initial dismissal. And a court doesn't have to list every kind of activity that you can't do. He was clearly telling Mr. Sanchez, look, no more violations of judicial procedures. And not only did a month later did he leak this document, but at that time he still had not paid the fine that was imposed as a sanction when the court revoked the first dismissal. Ms. Samarin's reply brief says, yes, he did pay the fine, but it doesn't say when. And, in fact, it happened after this case was dismissed. Mr. Sanchez continued to violate court orders and procedures even after the first warning. In terms of whether it's too harsh a punishment, Judge Shader analyzed whether, as he put it, whether the punishment fits the crime. He said he was quoting Gilbert and Sullivan to that effect. But you read the order and you see that he found it proportional given the nature of the breach, the lack of integrity, the irremediability of a leak like this, the fact that you can't really cure it, and the deterrent purpose of the sanctions. Mr. Levenstam said that Sameron did nothing wrong, but and he said that we didn't cite any cases where it was just the attorneys who did the wrong that led to a dismissal sanction. Well, first, there's the Morocco case from this court, which says that the misconduct was by the attorneys and their experts, and the court nevertheless imposed a dismissal sanction. And in fact, virtually not all, but most of the lack of prosecution cases involve attorney misconduct, not client misconduct, and yet many of those, including the Link case at the Supreme Court and National Hockey League, involved led to dismissal sanctions. And the question of impact, you know, the WikiLeaks article that posted this agreement had 13 questions about the supposed criminality that this contract allegedly shows. Now, we don't think it shows any criminality, of course, but there was tremendous harm both in terms of not only the leak of the competitive information, but reputational harm as well. On the First Amendment issue, you know, if you read every brief or transcript in the district court, you will not see the First Amendment or the U.S. Constitution mentioned. So we think that issue is waived. But even if it's not, as I said, you don't have a right to breach a confidentiality agreement. Now, Mr. Levenstam suggests that there's sort of some sort of public service or public interest involved in disclosing this document. But that's totally inconsistent with Mr. Sanchez's statements below that he exercised bad judgment. And by the way, that exercise bad judgment statement that he made a couple times below is inconsistent with the notion that he just forgot about the confidentiality of the document. A bad judgment is a bad decision and a willful one, and it's inconsistent with the notion that there was some sort of public interest involved in disclosing this document. With that, if there's no more questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Charles, one more minute.
First of all, with respect to the admission of exercising bad judgment, you're darn tootin' he exercised bad judgment. He turned that article over or that contract over, and it made absolutely no benefit to his client whatsoever. And it wound up messing up his client's lawsuit. And so, yeah, it was bad judgment. That doesn't mean he knew that it was supposed to be kept confidential. That's completely apart. In terms of what's in the agreement, the fact of the matter is that it's clear from the Chronicle articles that the sensitive nature of the agreement was that the Department of Education had not seen this relationship between Sallie Mae and USA Funds, where USA Funds, which was supposed to be overseeing Sallie Mae as the lender, contracted its oversight obligations as guarantor to Sallie Mae, the lender. And that was a question that was of considerable public interest. The Inspector General of the department said, this is wrong. And then a department a superior said, no, it's not wrong. And ultimately, those Chronicle articles indicated that the department objectively said it was not wrong. So there really was no harm particularly to flow from this. Certainly nothing to justify dismissal of Ms. Salmeron's case.
All right. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take that under advisement and